This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we learn about a self-serve grocery store. But we are going to start today with two words that you might not think go together that well: government and innovation. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs operates the nation's largest integrated healthcare system. But how much do you know about VA medical centers and clinics and how they can identify innovative therapies, practices, and policies, and then have a large footprint to distribute those? Dr. Ryan Vega leads the innovation ecosystem within the VA, and he talks about that ecosystem being a catalyst for discovery of innovation to advance healthcare. He speaks with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, the hosts of the Conversations on Healthcare podcast.
Dr. Vega, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Hey, Mark, thanks for having me.
Explain more about the innovation ecosystem.
It's our obligation to care for. And that's really important because that must extend beyond just the provision of healthcare. And so our innovation mission must be the catalyst and the fuel to making sure that we're thinking about upstream prevention and how we enable downstream experiences that contribute to the veteran's entire whole health and their journey. We're now combined three offices. And those offices focus on the ability to really test and validate emerging technologies and solutions using clinical simulation, really thinking about testing a new solution out in an operating room, really understanding the implications on the workflow, and then deploying it. We have another office, our innovation ecosystem, which thinks both about the internal investments that we must make, as well as how we create opportunities to bring industry. This could be Fortune 500 companies and startups. These could be non-traditional players. How do we bring them into the fold? And then we sort of complete that with our Center for Care and Payment Innovation. And this is really important in healthcare because often solutions are introduced into a market that it's not really fully prepared for, whether that's how you pay for it, whether that's the IT solution or even practice variation amongst providers, so that solutions can really create meaningful value for both patients, clinicians, and the systems that care for them.
So you referenced the Shark Tank. Tell us about that idea. How does it work?
Really, the idea is, how do you create a culture where individuals on the front lines now have access to this national opportunity, this national network, where the work that they're doing at one VA has the opportunity to spread across. And we get hundreds of applications a year. We really focus and get those down to the 10 that have some level of evidence. So there's pretty in-depth reviews on the practice or the solution. And two, those that really seem to have the most potential for impact for veterans. This doesn't have to just be technology. These can be processy changes. It could be even potential policy changes. But the other piece of this is that our medical center directors and even our network directors, they're bidding on these practices, which means they're going to invest to get these projects replicated at their site because they see a need. And it's that replication and that willingness and that buy-in that enables us to really test solutions in multiple different markets. We really get to test and vet these solutions out. And what you know about any innovation, it's a very narrow funnel when you get to the end. Not everything's going to make it, but this allows us to really energize the front line, to tap into that entrepreneurial spirit. They're the best position to understand what's potentially going to work because they're the ones actually doing the work. And so Shark Tank has really sort of fostered that both entrepreneurial spirit, and some of the practices we have seen come out of that are not just changing and saving lives in the VA, but they're actually spreading across American hospitals and saving lives there as well.
You've written in the New England Journal of Medicine about the four critical elements that support the development and deployment of innovation in a health system: workforce capacity to actualize innovation, an organizational infrastructure that supports integrated, repeatable pathways for change, and a strategic external partnership and collaboration. I'm wondering how you came to those points, and do you think the VA is meeting them right now?
So I think we came to them by a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
Which fortunately, part of innovation is about failing, failing forward, failing and learning. But I have failed way more in this role than I have succeeded. But those characteristics seem to be very, very important for healthcare, partially because when you talk about the human capital, and certainly 2.5+ years through the pandemic, you know, we're seeing the toll that not investing in human capital can have on the system as a whole. You need that capacity. You need that human capital to be the not only evangelists, but the individuals who are going to carry the torch forward, right? It's really, really hard. And so if you're not investing in your people, if you're not giving them the tools that they need to drive the change and continuously investing in their ideas and their solutions, then piggies back into, well, how is your culture? It has to be a culture that creates safe spaces to fail forward. Mm-hmm. Meaning a lot of what we do in our innovators network is make large, small investments, meaning less than $1 million on investing in hundreds of different projects or ideas, recognizing that the majority of them will never mature. But that's not necessarily the point. It's those hundreds of employees that are going through that experience, that are learning new skill sets and how to apply them to problem solving that grows. But really what we've seen since this sort of ecosystem has evolved is a growing, and I use the word sort of lightly, group of evangelists. These are individuals out in the field who are better equipped to solve problems. They're coming up with great solutions, whether it impacts one veteran or millions. They're going to continuously be committed to that mission of the innovation role and how it solves problems today, tomorrow, and in the future for the American veteran.
You wrote that the VA is perhaps an unlikely source for this type of innovative talk. And certainly, I look back and think about who had the electronic health record before anybody else. Veteran Affairs had the electronic health record, your patient-aligned care teams. So are you saying that maybe because it's VA and people aren't expecting that innovation, that some of your successes don't get the same uptake or spread around the country? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I think that's the challenge of being in government. There's a sentiment or a sense generally that government's slow and inefficient and probably not sort of the beacon of innovation that maybe we associate Silicon Valley or other markets with. But I do think it's sometimes hard where you have constant drumbeat of information that paints the VA or other agencies in sort of a more negative light. And I get it. That's what's going to drive press or certain clicks, so to speak. But the reality is that if you look at the history of healthcare innovation and some of the leading research and development, VA has moved healthcare in America and globally forward. We were doing so during the pandemic in the utilization of point of care manufacturing, so 3D printing, and how we were able to create both diagnostic testing swabs, personal protective equipment. We were doing so years and years and years ago when we invented the first cardiac pacemaker. So I think that's our history. I think what enables us to truly drive transformation is a commitment to the mission, because I'm not beholden. I don't have some of the same market constraints that our commercial partners may. And I have clinicians and providers who, whether they're in California, Alaska, or Florida, or walking into a VA hospital or showing up to work every day, united by the same mission. So they're collaborating. So I've got some of the best and brightest minds across the country coming together to solve these problems. When you do that, when you have that infrastructure, you're going to see innovation that not only changes the experience or the care for the veteran, but it's going to spread across healthcare globally.
We certainly were all put to the test during those early days of COVID. We needed to be able to turn on a dime, and the innovation ecosystem really also responded in remarkable ways. Can you share that with our audience?
So we've been investing in point of care manufacturing, which is really this idea that you can utilize 3D printing to create anything you can imagine seeing on a desktop computer in specific software, dating back to 2014, 15, but really began to pick up steam with the development of our 3D printing network. And that was in place before the pandemic hit. So it really enabled us to leverage the breadth of talent across our VA medical centers that were doing this type of work to really push American healthcare forward in how we can utilize manufacturing in the walls of the hospital during times of the pandemic, this was really supply chain resiliency and producing materials. But it's really grown beyond that now, so that we're understanding how customized orthotics and prosthetics and personalized surgical instruments, and in the future, actually biofabricating tissue and bone and in our lifetime, likely organs. So I think that's one example of what you saw coming out of the pandemic, but certainly out of necessity, we were able to really pull together that talent and drive it forward. You also saw small projects that have grown into really remarkable solutions. We had a pilot going on in the Massachusetts area where we were utilizing rideshare, particularly just to get veterans to and from appointments. These were veterans that may have difficulty getting transportation, and certainly giving them safe transportation was really important. Instead of just letting that pause during the pandemic because clinics were closed, and they pivoted and utilized that to actually deliver food and materials and goods that were needed. But veterans who relied upon those services or who were concerned about going out into public. And then from there, it really grew. People saw the power of using these types of solutions. And so you saw collaborations and public-private partnerships with Uber Health. And the impact has just been phenomenal on the American veteran and how we're really creating that ecosystem that's enabled us to leverage multiple different capabilities from internal and external to deliver a world-class experience.
I was thinking as you were talking about some of the 3D printing work, especially the new tool, you know, the new object is sometimes easier for teams on the front line of delivering care to embrace and adopt than innovating the way people work together, innovating the way they communicate. How have you in VA evolved to engage people, to win the hearts and minds of people about disrupting processes and changing things that they've done for a long time?
I don't think that's ever going to not be a challenge. So innovation is always going to be at odds with existing operations. As you're trying to change the way that something is delivered or experienced, I think one of the ways you do that is, at least in mitigating some of the initial resistance, is you have to bring people in early on to the design phase. And you can leverage design thinking or human-centered design. And as you're going through how to enhance a particular experience or approach a problem, everybody wants to make things better. But sometimes we're looking at things through very, very unique vantage points. And so it's not about sort of saying, we're going to make your process better. It's really about how do we collectively come together and create a new experience or a new outcome. And so I think it starts by bringing people in very early on to the design phase. If they're part of the solution, generally the resistance is a lot less. It still is never going to be perfect. And innovation, and particularly if you look in other markets, you know, those new entries, those new disruptors, they're not looked at kindly. But that's just sort of a fact of how innovation is. And the key characteristics is bringing those individuals, those large, diverse stakeholders into the process very early on makes a huge difference.
The partnerships that you've developed, talk to us about some of the results of those partnerships and the impact and the sort of the ripple effect, if you will, across the country's healthcare system.
Yeah, one that I think really just speaks to VA's role and unique position within the larger American health system is one called HAPPEN. So this was a nurse researcher who was doing great work about understanding how to reduce non-ventilator-associated pneumonias. But her work had really exposed the idea that something as simple as brushing teeth, reducing the potential bacteria in the mouth for veterans, could really reduce non-ventilator-associated pneumonia. And that is a project that actually showed really great results at one VA medical center. It got into the Shark Tank. It won. It started to be replicated at multiple different hospitals. And it was that ability to sort of replicate in multiple markets, in multiple settings, and continuously get the data that the interest of some of our other federal agencies, folks like the CDC, the American Hospital Association, and other private health systems began to take notice to say, this is an issue across all hospitals in America. This is potentially a solution. It's pretty inexpensive. And what you started to see was that role as VA is not only sort of the driver, but really the convener. We have large populations and access to mass amounts of data where we can really understand things such as, hey, we've got this bundle. Do we implement it for everyone? Not only are we informing our own drive and how we're going to do this, but the rest of healthcare can adopt that. So we've seen a reduction in non-virally associated pneumonia. That means that's a reduction in the number of deaths.
That's right.
And so this is something that I think we're really proud of, because when we were enabled to get this solution, this information scaled more broadly across the American health system. And as a result, we're going to see people's lives be saved.
Healthcare is expensive, but I'm wondering if you might give some parting thoughts to those who are just beginning innovation. And I really want you maybe to focus in on those plan, do, study, act teams, you know, those capturing engagement of staff and really trying to have them, as we've talked about earlier, be force multipliers with small ideas. Maybe some advice for that smaller organization who's really saying, I want to do it, I just don't know how to start.
So a couple of things. You can never spend enough time in the discovery and the design phase. So I think that is absolutely crucial. It does not cost much to sit down and really understand the problem through somebody else's lens. So I think utilizing human-centered design and spending as much time as you can really understanding the problem, and that problem from multiple different stakeholders and perspectives, generally gets you to a better solution. Mm-hmm. Not always, but I'm willing to bet that it more often than not will. The second is, I really think it's important to remind people this idea of value. It's really a dynamic concept. You can't say, okay, here's how we define value. And the reason I say that is because, one, it's really hard in healthcare. Two, we've generally looked at it from a cost standpoint, but that's not the case. I mean, what's valuable to me may not be valuable to you. What's valuable to one population may not be valuable to the other. Value is a very dynamic concept. And if we can measure it as such across multiple different domains, things like how accessible was the care, how efficient was it, how equitable was it? These are things that now actually enable us to move beyond just the idea of cost and really start to look at solutions that we can actually deploy at scale that will really begin to bend the cost curve. We've sort of been talking about this for a long period of time. Costs are still going up, but I think it's this idea that if we move away from that very narrow, limited lens of value, that you really will find solutions that are going to move the needle. So those two things, I think, are really, really important for teams that are starting.
Dr. Vega, again, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
That was Dr. Ryan Vega, who leads the innovation ecosystem for the VA, in conversation with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, hosts of the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, which comes to us from the Community Health Center of Connecticut. Tom Ezern is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Otto Bremer Trust, investing in people, places, and opportunities in North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Learn more at ottobremer.org.
Hi, I'm John Brousseau on the Next Great American Folk Show, a live session from Josh Rouse, whose laid-back summertime grooves were cooked up in his transplanted home in Spain. Plus, Juno Award-winning Canadian folk artists Ferris and Jason Romero. Speaking of Canada, Willie Watson covers folk legend the late Stan Rogers. And we've got cowboy poetry from Marcy Broyhill. The Great American Folk Show. Listen Saturday at 5 p.m. Central Time on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and at the height of summer, there is nothing like popping some fresh fruit in your mouth. But not every year are you going to get a good harvest. In this week's Plains Folk essay, historian Tom Ezern bemoans the yield of one of our earlier season crops in Lament for Juneberries.
I just came in from an inspection tour of the Prairie Garden, and the news is bad. The Juneberry crop is not worth harvesting this year. Maybe it was the hard winter, maybe the late freeze, maybe the spring flood, or maybe the siroccos of early summer. But we have so few berries, I'm just leaving them for the birds. which is something to lament, for Juneberries are a culinary staple at our place on Willow Creek. Pies are without doubt the most popular use for these purple pearls, and Dr. Kelly's Goonberry pies are legend. Yes, you heard me right, I said Goonberry. Juneberries alone are insufficiently tart for our tastes, so we mixed them with green gooseberries, Pixwell gooseberries, in fact, a 1930 NDAC release selected from the wild. Gooseberry plus Juneberry equals Goonberry, my favorite pie. Dr. Kelly also produces a berry cobbler with Juneberries and gooseberries. Years ago, he began calling this dish, on account of its appearance, speckled pup. Juneberry muffins are our standard breakfast muffin. Juneberries plump up as they bake, so they burst into flavor when you tuck in. The flavor has notes of vanilla, which is perfect for muffins. Do your health a favor and mix in some wheat flour. Nobody likes a cakey muffin anyway. We don't use Juneberries for jam or jelly. We have lots of other fine fruits for jam and jelly. We do, however, make a savory use of Juneberries that I haven't heard of anyone else doing. My favorite salad is a bowl of greens topped with Juneberries and blue cheese. Some red onion is good in there, too. Dress this with a nutty oil. Sunflower is fine, but you can also get fancy with walnut or almond oil. And although red wine vinegar works, I like to splash in something tart and fruity, maybe currant juice. We know a lot of people who pick Juneberries from the wild, but they do well in cultivation. You can dig up wild suckers. I would recommend getting a named variety from a nursery, because that way you can control for height. You see, you're going to have to net the bushes when the berries commence to ripen. Get good quality nets that don't tangle or snag. If you don't net, you're just feeding the birds. The only years we didn't need nets over our bushes were ones when a family of Cooper's hawks nested in an ash tree alongside the prairie garden. Three species in particular love Juneberries, and combined, they will take them all. Cedar waxwings invest the higher branches and will not budge until sated. They are gorgeous thieves, of course. Robins are the most vexatious poachers, active, noisy, and aggressive in the middle branches. Down below, brown thrashers flit up from the ground. Besides their multiple culinary uses, Juneberries have the virtue of easy handling. They are convenient to pick, growing in nice clusters. They don't ripen quite evenly, but some pink ones in the indigo mix are fine. I wouldn't bother with canning, because Juneberries are a freezer fruit par excellence. You don't have to do that thing where you spread them out and freeze-dry them. Just see that they are reasonably dry when you pack them into containers or bags, and they hardly stick to one another at all when frozen. The first Euro-American settler newspaper mention of Juneberries I find in North Dakota is from the Emmons County Leader, 15th of July, 1885. The gentle Juneberry is now abroad in the land, and the men, women, and children round about Williamsport have pursued it with much energy and success.
Dr. Tom Usern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, an effort to increase access to healthy food in food deserts. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Rural Health Clinic Network has received a $100,000 federal grant to help support the 55 rural health clinics across North Dakota. The North Dakota Network was established late last year through the UND Center for Rural Health, which applied for the grant.
We identified that there was no support for the RHCs in our state, and we wanted to make sure that those clinics receive support and resources to stay relevant and keep providing services in our rural communities.
Anna Walter is the project coordinator for the network. She says those clinics provide primary care services in rural communities. She says all of those clinics are owned or operated by North Dakota's 37 critical access hospitals.
It's kind of like your stop in maintaining that care and keeping their communities well.
Walter says this grant will help those clinics provide the care the communities need, especially in rural North Dakota.
Our rural communities are so important, and the access that they have to care gets kind of tough sometimes with some travel restrictions. And so keeping these rural health clinics and these hospitals open is very vital to those rural communities.
This is a one-year grant. Walter says the plan is to seek a three-year grant, and she says the application for that will be filed this fall. Deputy Insurance Commissioner John Arnold says it's estimated that anywhere from 13 to 20% of motorists in North Dakota do not carry auto insurance. He says this creates many issues when it comes to who pays for what in motor vehicle accidents. If the at-fault driver doesn't carry insurance, then the burden of those costs falls to the other driver. And Arnold says this in turn makes everyone's insurance premiums go up. Arnold says the insurance department is working on a way to combat this by testing out a blockchain technology that could identify who the uninsured drivers are.
So what we're going to do is have the Department of Transportation put all the vehicle identification numbers or the VIN numbers onto a secure ledger that using blockchain technology and put those VINs out there, and then have the insurance company say, okay, which of these VINs do you have a policy for? And then we'll be able to narrow down which vehicles are registered but do not have insurance on them.
He says the findings may be presented to the legislature next year. And the North Dakota Department of Agriculture is opening the Soil Health Cover Crop Grant Program for applications. Ag Commissioner Doug Goring says the grant is meant to target cropland areas impacted with saline or alkaline soils.
It's giving producers the ability and the opportunity where they haven't really thought about it before to look at establishing a cover crop there that can help to start improve soil health, utilizing some of the salt and getting them out of the soil to help establish more organic matter.
To qualify, farmers must plant the cover crops in their fields by mid-September. There is a 160-acre cap per applicant. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
For their next primetime public hearing, the January 6th committee will take a look at President Trump's actions on the day of the insurrection.
Donald Trump never picked up the phone that day to order his administration to help. This is not ambiguous.
Join us for live coverage and analysis from NPR News.
Listen Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Across the country, small town grocery stores are disappearing, largely due to shrinking profit margins and rising costs. In one town in central Minnesota, a young couple is testing a model that cuts costs and engages local residents. From our friends at Minnesota Public Radio, Dan Gunderson reports on a self-serve grocery store.
Alex and Kayleen Austinson moved to the small town of Evansville about 5 years ago to be closer to family. The local grocery store, in business for more than 70 years, had just closed. That meant at least a 40-mile round-trip drive just to get basic groceries. So Kayleen says the couple started brainstorming ideas to operate a store sustainably in the town of 600.
We had just been hearing a lot from people, man, it would be nice if we had a grocery store back in town. That's something we really miss. It is a staple. It's a cornerstone, part of a community.
Alex is a diesel mechanic by training, but he likes problem solving, so he looked to technology for a solution. People who buy a $75 annual membership get 24/7 access to the store through a phone app. Kayleen demonstrates the phone app that opens the front door.
All you need to do is go up and press the button, and it recognizes it. It unlocks, and you're good to go.
This small Main Street storefront is tiny compared to a traditional supermarket, but the shelves are filled with the basics, and customers can request special orders on a chalkboard hanging on the wall. Customers can scan items with their phone and pay using the app. There's also a key fob option and a scanner for those who aren't comfortable using their phone. The technology tracks customers and their purchases. Only members using their phone or fob to unlock the door are allowed in. The store also has security cameras, and theft has not been an issue. The store is staffed 3 days a week, but the focus is on anytime access. Alex Austinson says the goal was to sign up 50 paying members in the first year. They hit that target in the first week.
With the boost of memberships right off the bat, that is what partially funded our first inventory. So you know, it helped us greatly right at the beginning.
Karen Howell and her husband were among the first to buy a Main Street grocery membership. She doesn't mind paying the $75 annual fee because the store saves a lot of 40-mile trips for groceries.
We don't do all of our shopping here because they aren't able to carry everything that I might want to buy. But we try to support them any way that we can because we're so proud to have them here.
Brandon Borgstrom is administrator at the local nursing home. He says with a busy life, the local store is a convenience worth paying for.
It's nice to go grab milk, eggs, bread, or, you know, it's Sunday afternoon and you're sitting down for dinner and you realize you don't have, you know, cream of mushroom soup for the green bean casserole you're going to make. You know, so just those little things that add up.
The store plans to expand offerings of local produce and locally produced things like honey and butter. Kayleen Ostenson says they've worked hard to overcome the perception that a small grocery is like a convenience store with limited choices and high-cost items. She says first-time customers are often surprised.
They realize, wow, these prices are they're a lot less than what I expected. And, yep, they have this and they have that. And we try to make sure to stock the basics for sure and then just grow and go from there.
Kathy Drager studies the viability of rural grocery stores at the University of Minnesota. She thinks this model is a good one to try to replicate.
Especially during times when gas prices are going high and there is a worker shortage, I think this is a really great innovation.
Alex was recently awarded a 2-year Rural Innovation Fellowship through a nonprofit. The stipend will allow him to stop working as a mechanic and now focus on working to expand his self-serve grocery model to other small towns. For NPR News, I'm Dan Gunderson in Evansville, Minnesota.
That story aired on All Things Considered last week. And now that you have gone and gotten some fresh produce and other groceries, well, now you need to prep them. And isn't it so frustrating when you pick up a knife and it's just not sharp enough to do the job? Well, how about getting your knife sharpened instead of just throwing it away and getting a new one? Josh Edmondson is a chef at Fargo's Mezzaluna, and he also has a booth for knife sharpening at the Red River Farmers Market. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
How'd you get into knife sharpening?
I work professionally in a kitchen, and obviously we need our knives to be sharp. I quickly learned that the best way to do that was with a whetstone.
What's a whetstone?
A block of stone, sometimes made from ceramic. I have one that's magnesium. It's essentially just an abrasive block that you put the edge of a knife against and wear it down until you have a new edge developed.
And how long does that process take?
It can take anywhere from 10 minutes to a half hour, depending on what kind of steel you have on the knife, what kind of shape it's in, and what the customer's looking to have done.
Yeah. When you say what kind of steel is on a knife, like what would happen if I brought in some knives from Target versus if I get, you know, those ones that you see on the documentaries made in Japan?
So the biggest difference, and now I'm not an expert on what makes, you know, different steels, they're like chemical composition or anything like that, but typically it's what's known as like a hard steel or a soft steel. Typically German-made knives are considered a softer steel that like has a Rockwell hardness number that is lower than 60, and above 60 is harder steels. So the softer steel is more flexible and resilient, where if it takes damage, it'll bend but not break, but it'll also not... you can't get it as sharp, essentially, because the softer steel can't handle a really acute angle. Now, the Japanese knives are very hard steel, but that also makes them more brittle. So if they take damage, they will end up chipping rather than bending. So they require a little more maintenance and careful handling.
Do you have a preference?
I use mostly Japanese knives in my personal use. For anything that's like vegetables or meat cutting, they're perfect for that. And then I have my couple German steel knives that I use for harsher cutting through harder vegetables like butternut squash or cutting around bone. stuff like that, where it can be hitting something like a hard surface where I'm worried about something chipping.
Well, there's that famous infomercial where they toss a watermelon up in the air and then they slice through it almost like a sword. Are you doing that?
I've definitely messed around doing that at home. I don't do that in the professional setting, but it is fun to play Fruit Ninja with your sharp knives.
And then do something with the fruit, right?
Yes, you can, of course. No waste.
How many knives do you have?
I actually just counted these last week because I was curious myself. I have 17.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you know one from the next, like, period, end of discussion, if you were blindfolded and somebody handed you?
I would bet yes, actually, I could. Just if I could, you know, feel them. Being in the kitchen, I have a lot of knives. Like, in a professional setting, I have a lot of knives with specific uses. So they have all different lengths, sizes, shapes that are all for their specific use.
Yeah, what happens if you try to, you know, slice a pear with a meat cleaver?
I mean, it'll still work. It's I mean, as long as your edge is sharp, you can kind of, I mean, that's why a chef's knife is really the only one you have to have, because it's so versatile. You can use it for almost anything as long as it's not, you know, extremely long.
Yeah, what makes the chef's knife so versatile? You know, of 17 knives, why is there only one called a chef's knife?
I guess essentially just because it's, you know, an 8-inch chef's knife is the most typical people would use, so it's just a nice length where you're gonna have the ability to cut anything on the cutting board in a length, the proper length, but you can also like choke up on it and hold it towards the tip, and you can use it almost like in a paring knife sense. You know, if you're comfortable with it, you can kind of manipulate it to fit everything. It's got ability to rock, chop, slice, dice.
Yeah.
It's basically you can get away with using it on anything if you don't want to get super specific with each knife you have.
Okay. What about proper technique for holding knives? How much of a difference does that make?
I would say it makes a big difference. You want to have comfortable control in the hand that you're holding. A lot of times you'll see people holding it. I always cringe when I see, like, on TV, like, someone pretending to do something in the kitchen and they're holding it so dangerously. But, you know, you want to have it nice and tight in your dominant hand with your fingers wrapped around it so you can have, you know, perfect control. And then for your non-knife hand is actually probably even more important, and that's your hand that's guiding your actual cuts, and that's the one, that, if you're not doing it right, you're going to hurt yourself.
You're going to slice your finger
open. So people might have heard of, like, the claw grip. That's typically what's called, where you wrap your, you keep your fingertips angled down and away from the food, and then the flats of your fingers are a guide for the face of the knife.
Wow. It's like you have to think of it like a fretboard on on a guitar.
Yeah,
almost,
that's actually a good way to put
it. Yeah. Well, can you sharpen a knife for me?
Okay.
So you've got a tub with a bucket of water in it, and then inside it looks like two different sanding discs.
Yeah, those are the whetstones.
Those are the whetstones, okay.
Yeah. So the ones that are actually in the water are soaking stones.
Okay.
Which are only the difference between those and my other ones are they don't need to be soaked. They can just, what they call, splash and go. So you can just put a little water on them and they're ready, and they don't need to be completely submerged.
Okay, so now you're loading a different, this must be one of the just toss and goes here.
Yeah, this is my spot. Actually, I'm going
to set it in the water.
I'm going to start, since I think this is a pretty dull knife that the customer gave me, I'm going to actually start with a 500 grit Shapton glass stone. That's a ceramic splash and go, so it just needs a little water on top. And so typically with a dull knife, you're going to obviously start with a lower grit and work your way up as you progress through the sharpening process. I'm ready to get started.
So are you looking for, like, nicks and cuts on the knives, or just kind of feeling it, you know?
Well, first thing I want to do is to, like, inspect the edge of the blade, see if there's any damage that's occurred on it, see if it's straight, check the what's called the choil shot, which is like the angle looking from the handle straight down. You can see the actual geometry of the blade.
Okay.
And that geometry is actually what's most important in the cutting process. They say shape matters more almost than the actual sharpening in a lot of ways.
Whoa,
so,
I didn't know that.
So that's like one of the biggest differences between like a cheap knife and like a real high-end knife is that that grind will be what they call like a distal taper from the heel of the knife to the edge will gradually come to a point, and the thinner that point is behind the edge, the less resistance you're going to feel when you're cutting.
Okay.
This is a pretty cheap knife from this customer, but I'll still get it nice and sharp for them.
Okay. So would a cheap knife theoretically need to be sharpened more often?
Yeah, essentially, because like I was talking about with the steel types, the crappier the steel, the less edge retention it'll have. It'll basically get dull faster. So when you're paying for like really high end Japanese knives that are extremely hard, they're gonna have the best edge retention and stay sharper longer.
Okay, so you're sliding the blade back and forth, just actually kind of rapidly on what, 7-8 inches of
I believe this is a 7-inch knife. So there's a lot of different techniques for this. Some people will do like one long stroke from edge to edge. I like to work in smaller segments.
Okay.
So I'm starting at the heel.
Okay.
With just two fingers pressure, and I like to do about 10 strokes.
Okay.
And then progress up about the same two-finger distance.
So you've moved two fingers up on the knife, and so you're just gentle pressure there.
Yep.
That's how you distinguish.
If it's really really dull, you might need to put a lot of pressure.
Okay.
But since this is a coarse stone, I'm just using moderate pressure for this.
Okay.
And then essentially when you're doing it by hand, the goal is to use lighter pressure with each progressing stone you're working on. So right now I'm going to go decently hard, but as I get to the final finishing stone, I'm going to be using like feather light pressure, getting into a little more of the actual process.
Yeah.
You're sharpening one side until you feel what's called a burr, and that's actually what I'm doing right now. I'm testing the edge to see where I've removed enough steel to create an apex on one side. When you're pushing the steel against the stone, eventually the side that's touching the stone will curl up and over the edge, which is almost imperceptible to the eye, but you can actually feel it once you kind of get used to it.
Hmm.
It feels like a little hair on the edge of the knife.
Okay.
So you want to sharpen until you have an evenly raised burr on the entire edge, and then you flip the knife over to the other side and then remove that burr, develop another one on that side, and then go up in grit on the stones until eventually when you're finally finished, you've got a very, very small burr, and then you do the deburring process, which just gets rid of that little hairline piece of steel and gives you a very refined edge.
Okay, and that's on a different stone?
Yeah, when I finish on the... For these cheaper knives, I usually finish on like an 800 grit.
Okay.
The grits are kind of different between brands, but what's most important is just kind of like using a coarse, medium, and then a fine stone to finish.
Okay.
And then I actually also have this... kangaroo leather strop.
Whoa.
With a 0.5 micron diamond spray, which is a bunch of jargon for some money I probably wasted, but essentially once you stropping on the leather is like you see like barbers do where they swing their razor across a piece of leather. Essentially what that's doing is removing any like micro material left behind on the stones and just giving you what they call like a really keen edge, that and that's what takes your knife from being cutting sharp to like razor sharp. You'll actually be able to shave your arm with it if I do it right after it touches the...
And are you doing this? You have a beard.
Yeah, you can see that my right arm actually, it's normally hairy,
this
is, I shave my arm sometimes just to see where...
you're serious.
Yeah, so...
Okay.
If it doesn't shave, then I'm kind of disappointed. I have to go back.
So. That's how you... I was going to ask, like, if you were cutting kiwi or something to test the knives.
Usually
you are
hair,
shaving your
paper,
arms here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Magazine paper is usually what I test on up until that point to see how sharp I have the knife.
Oh, wow, magazine paper.
It's thinner. It's like the thinnest paper you can... I mean, I guess that's not the thinnest paper you can have, but what I have on hand, if it can cut through thin magazine paper, then you know that it's got no resistance, essentially, because the paper's so thin it'll start to turn before it'll cut.
Okay. What are you doing at the farmer's market?
Well, I got the idea... I got the idea, actually, from a knife forum on Reddit that people who sharpen knives started up at a farmer's market, and I figured that would probably be a cool place to get out and do demonstrations and show people the process, hopefully get them interested in it enough to where they would like to get the same thing done.
So, people, this is the second week?
This is my second week, yeah.
Okay, so how does this work? Do people bring knives and then pick them up the next week? Do they?
So far, I've been able to get everything done the same day. Hopefully, the volume gets high enough to the point that I will have to postpone some till the next day. But I just take people's contact information and I get a hold of them when their knife is done. They can either come pick it up or I can deliver it to them.
Ooh,
whatever
knife
works.
Delivery.
Yeah.
That's pretty fun. Yeah, I saw a guy dropped off knives, and he had, like, that classic, you know, chef's, I don't know, what do you call those, the chef
call
knife?
It a knife roll.
Knife roll, thank you. You know, and it said chef on it, and the guy was, like, he had probably 12 different knives in there. Yeah, many tattoos.
He looked
that
like
shows
a, like
up a lot with people who like knives.
Yeah. It's the typical chef look, which I don't myself, I don't have myself, but... I definitely respect.
Those sharp objects, you know, needles and knives. Are you going to shave your arms right now?
I'm not to that step yet. I've just got the burr on both sides of this knife. Now I'm just doing even light strokes on both sides of the knife.
Okay.
Removing that burr. So now I've got do a little cut test to see if I didn't miss any parts
of the
knife.
Any volunteers? He's doing a cut test.
I'm just... I got this little slice of magazine paper.
I was going to say fingertips, but... Oh, okay. So, I want to hear this. Oh, yeah. That is a surprisingly clean edge.
I fell a couple little snags there, so it looks like I have to go back and touch up a few spots. But pretty good for the most part.
And you could tell that by feel?
Yeah,
you could tell that by look?
You can kind of see it, but right there, it kind of caught a little bit as I was sliding.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
Caught a little bit there.
Yeah. Tiny pause.
Yeah.
In that fluid.
Which won't,
in
the, I mean, if you're just normally using a knife, those little nicks, you probably won't notice them at all, but
yeah.
I'm kind of anal about getting them just right.
Well, you know, people who work in a kitchen have high standards.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that
kind of what makes restaurants, why people go to restaurants, dude.
I can't stand having a knife that isn't extremely sharp, so I find myself sharpening my knives at least once a week.
Once a week?
Yeah.
Whoa. Well, Josh, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was chef and knife sharpener Josh Edmondson with Hand and Stone Sharpening. You can drop off knives at the Red River Market Saturdays from 10 to 2 or find Hand and Stone Sharpening on Facebook. Dakota Datebook is next.
Capital Shakespeare of Bismarck presents William Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor, July 20th through 24th at 7 p.m. nightly. Performances are free and open to the public and are held on the grounds of the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum at the Outdoor Prairie Amphitheater. The Merry Wives of Windsor is a raucous comedy about larger-than-life character John Falstaff and his attempts to woo the uninterested Mistress Ford. More information can be found online at capitalshakespeare.org.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 20th. On this date in 1915, the big news in North Dakota was the opening of the state fair. The event garnered page one headlines in newspapers across the state. Thousands of visitors were expected to arrive in Grand Forks in caravans of automobiles and on special state fair trains. The first day of the fair was a smashing success, blessed with perfect weather. Organizers predicted it would be the best and most successful state fair ever presented. There was, however, more disturbing news throughout the papers. While the United States stubbornly resisted getting involved in what was regarded as a European war, there were uneasy signs that the conflict might force itself on the country. In 1914, President Wilson had declared that the United States would remain neutral. He said America could be, quote, impartial in thought as well as in action, unquote. That proved easier said than done. In May 1915, American passengers were killed when a German submarine sank the Lusitania. American sentiment began to turn towards support for Great Britain. North Dakota had a large population of citizens of German descent, which likely contributed to anti-war sentiment. Buried in the back pages behind articles lauding the state fair, the Grand Forks Daily Herald printed a letter that expressed skepticism about the wisdom of becoming involved. The author referenced German assurances that American vessels would not be targeted and that Americans on neutral vessels were not in jeopardy. The letter stated, "The German government is showing that it is anxious to retain our friendship and not harm the interests of the American people or the American government." The letter asserted that concern about German submarine warfare was less about the safety of American ships and passengers and more about coming to the rescue of Great Britain. The author stated that American passengers should not be transported on ships that also carried ammunition. American citizens, he said, should not be used as a shield for war materials. The Lusitania had carried ammunition as well as passengers. On April 6, 1917, the United States finally declared war on Germany. Americans rushed to recruiting stations to sign up for military service, but as the letter in a North Dakota newspaper demonstrates, not everyone supported that difficult decision. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we learn about the Hayloft Theater in Ashley, North Dakota, and its goal to become the best arts destination in South Central North Dakota. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.